Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Matthew Ho, Associate Director of the Eisenhower Media Network, who examines why Iran now appears to have an upper hand in the costly war of choice launched by the U.S. and Israel 5 weeks ago. Xavier Dejanan, an attorney representing a defendant in the Prairie Land Texas terrorism trial, who warns that the Trump Department of Justice criminalization of dissent threatens every American's right to free speech. And Kika Matos, president of the National Immigration Law Center, who assesses the Senate-confirmed Trump nomination of Oklahoma Republican Senator Mark Wade Mullen as the new secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Weeks after the U.S. military kidnapped Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, economic pressure on the communist government in Havana, Cuba, has escalated. Soon after President Trump cut off subsidized oil imports from Venezuela and Mexico, blackouts became a daily occurrence, and even the widely admired Cuban medical system was impaired as vulnerable patients faced life-threatening crises due to power outages. On March 29th, a Russian oil tanker carrying 730,000 barrels of oil was reportedly headed toward Cuba with apparently no interference from the Trump regime. To regain leverage, leaders in Havana have engaged in back-channel talks with the Trump administration and have begun discussing new economic reforms. Fidel Castro's great-nephew, Oscar Perez Oliva Fraga, recently appeared on state television to advocate for a new policy that would allow Cubans living abroad to own businesses on the island and invest in infrastructure. If enacted, it would be among Cuba's most significant economic reforms since the fall of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s. Applying additional pressure, Washington has coerced nations around the world to expel Cuban doctors and nurses, which for decades have provided Havana with a steady supply of foreign currency. Due to recent fuel shortages, tourism, another important source of income for Cuba, has ground to a halt. After weeks of surging oil prices due to the U.S. and Israeli war on Iran that closed down the Strait of Hormuz, Philippines President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. declared an energy emergency to address the current disruption of fuel delivery impacting the distribution of food, medicines, and agricultural products. Marcos empowered a committee to ensure the orderly movement of basic goods across the country and prevent the hoarding and profiteering of petroleum products. The emergency declaration issued on March 24th came after Philippines transport workers, commuters, and consumer groups threatened to hold a two-day strike to protest fuel prices, which have more than doubled over pre-war levels in February. Since the Iran war broke out, the Marcos government has provided subsidies to transport drivers, reduced ferry services, and implemented a four-day work week for civil servants in order to save fuel. Asian nations have been hard hit by the effective closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Last year, nearly 90% of all oil and gas that passed through the waterway was bound for Asia. The March heat dome in the American West that broke 1,500 record temperatures across 11 states is threatening to rapidly melt the sparse snowpack and ramp up wildfire risks in the seasons ahead. The Guardian reports that extreme heat is exceptionally dangerous, especially so early in the year. After one of the warmest winters in the West, the snow that feeds streams, reservoirs, and soil moisture as it melts through the summer season is already dismally scarce in key watersheds. The unprecedented heat wave pushed temperatures between 20 to 30 degrees Fahrenheit higher than average across the region, with some areas seeing spikes up to 40 degrees Fahrenheit above normal average temperatures. Parts of California and Arizona reached 112 degrees Fahrenheit, just 1 degree shy of April's heat record. Frederick Otto, a climate science professor at Imperial College London, observed, "Climate change is pushing weather into extremes that would have been unthinkable in a pre-industrial world." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran entered a fifth week, President Trump warned again that he would soon order U.S. forces to obliterate Iran's energy plants, oil wells, and strike Iran's desalination plants, a war crime, if the Islamic Republic doesn't reopen the Strait of Hormuz, where 20% of the world's oil and gas transits. Since the start of the war, the U.S. and Israel have attacked 21 universities in Iran, prompting Iranian officials to warn that in response, their military would target U.S. and Israeli-affiliated universities across the Middle East. In an erratic series of statements and social media posts, Trump said the war could end in 2 to 3 weeks as he threatened to deploy U.S. ground forces and urged U.S. European allies to take military action on their own to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Trump has repeatedly said he's engaged in constructive negotiations with Iranian leaders, despite denials from Iran's foreign minister. Since the war was launched, at least 1,900 Iranians have been killed in U.S.-Israeli airstrikes. At least 1,200 Lebanese have died in an Israeli offensive in southern Lebanon, while Iranian missile and drone attacks have killed 19 people in Israel and up to 36 in Gulf states. Thus far, 13 U.S. service members have been killed, with over 350 injured. Your reporter spoke with Matthew Ho, associate director of the Eisenhower Media Network, a former Marine captain, Iraq War combat veteran, and a U.S. State Department officer in Afghanistan, who resigned in protest over U.S. war policy in 2009. Here he examines why Iran now appears to have an upper hand in this war of choice, started by the U.S. and Israel some 5 weeks ago.
As time goes on, the war favors Iran. But we've seen that Iran prepared for this war. They resourced themselves. They had a strategic plan for the war based upon achieving their political objectives. And their immediate political objectives are to establish or reestablish deterrence so that a war like this cannot happen in the future and that their sovereignty is protected. And the way the Iranians calculate they can achieve that is by putting so much pressure, creating so much economic harm, not just in the region, but throughout the world, that is the pressure that in the future would prevent the United States from carrying out a war like this again, make this war so costly, not simply to the Americans and the Israelis, but to America's allies throughout the region as well as throughout the world, that in the coming years, the ability of the United States to do something like this again will be severely limited. Essentially, the way the Iranians have carried out the strategy to achieve that objective is, as you stated, by waging economic warfare, putting the world on the path to global recession, and quite possibly, if the worst outcomes, as can be assessed in terms of the crippling of energy production in the Middle East occur, quite possibly a global depression. And likewise, too, the other way they have carried out their strategy to achieve their objectives is by expanding the war throughout the region, so that this war is just not between three countries. It now involves, I think, 13 countries total, the number of countries that have been hit by missiles and drones.
Right.
So you see with the Iranians here, a very clear-eyed, rational, thought-out strategy to achieve, again, clear understandable and attainable objectives. And then you contrast that to, say, the Americans in all this, where the goal simply is to assure American dominance. But how do you get to that? You know, and you see a really a clearly a mismatch here that makes the assessment that the Iranians are, you know, I hate using the term winning the war, but that they certainly are in a position of strength in this war. The war over time favors them. And since the, I would say, third or fourth day of the war, the Iranians have had the initiative.
Matthew, there are now some 50,000 U.S. troops in the Middle East, with another 10,000 that, as of last week, were en route. The Trump White House has signaled they could be planning these troops to either try to reopen the Strait of Hormuz by occupying Karg Island in the strait, or recover 1,000 pounds of uranium that could be buried under tons of rubble from the earlier U.S.-Israeli airstrikes on Iranian nuclear facilities. What's your view of the likelihood that the U.S. will deploy ground troops in Iran and the cost of such a deployment?
I think first, the unpopularity of it is very clear. I just saw, I think it was a Reuters poll that had about 7% of Americans supportive of a ground invasion of Iran. As the person who was commenting on this poll said, you know, that's an even lower percentage of support than the U.S. Congress has, you know. So if you've got a, you've got something that has less support than the American Congress does these days, you know, it's incredibly unpopular. And so to carry out such a thing would be very unwise and foolish. It would be reckless, particularly as it seems as if the Iranians are expecting such a ground assault, some type of incursion, some type of occupation, and very much hope that it will occur, because it plays into their strategy. Another aspect for the Iranians is in terms of making costs, the costs measurable in the sense that they deter any future war, is this idea of imposing physical costs on the United States, bodily costs, casualties. And the Iranians have said this out loud before this war even started, that they would hope to kill at least 500 Americans. And that, in their calculation, that would be the number needed to make a war in the future by the U.S. politically impossible. The idea that such an assault will be playing into the Iranians' hands, or that you'd be doing what your enemy wants you to do, that's something that I think most people understand why you shouldn't carry such a thing out. But, I mean, in terms of what's available in the region, the forces, you know, 50,000 American troops in the Middle East, almost all of them being what's called combat service support. So logisticians, communication operators, radar technicians, pilots, truck drivers, things like that, not actual war fighters. That 50,000 number is a fraction of the number that was in the region for the invasion of Iraq, where I think more than 250,000 or close to 300,000 American service members were in the region in the lead up to the 2003 invasion. So we just don't see the forces available to carry out the type of large ground combat that I think many people have in mind. Other idea would be that these are small operations, raids. And I think many people suspect that the idea would be that these would serve as photo ops, that essentially this allows the administration to try and gain some type of initiative here, to try and get the headlines back in their favor. The idea of putting American Marines or paratroopers or commandos someplace, have them raise the flag on some Iranian beach, and some photos and videos are taken, and that's used to demonstrate American success. That then, of course, could be the finale for this war. That might be the event that allows the administration to say, look, we've won, and declare victory and go home. Of course, whether the Iranians would agree to that is a very big question.
That was Matthew Ho, Associate Director of the Eisenhower Media Network, a former Marine captain and Iraq War combat veteran. Find more analysis and commentary on the state of the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On the 4th of July last year, supporters of people held in the Prairie Land ICE Detention Center in Alvarado, Texas, held a noise and fireworks protest outside the facility to show their support for the detainees inside. At the end of the demonstration, a local police officer arrived, shots were fired, and 10 people were arrested. A group of 9 were convicted on March 13th on federal domestic terrorism and other charges. They face at least 15 years in prison. The defendants are being held in jail pending sentencing later this year. The group also faces state charges with bail set at $1 million. This is the first time the Trump Department of Justice has succeeded in bringing domestic terrorism charges against activists who they accuse of being members of Antifa. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Xavier Dejanon, co-founder of the People's Law Collective, which represents political defendants across the South. Dejanon, a member of the National Lawyers Guild, represents one of the defendants, Elizabeth Soto, in her state case, and provided support to defense attorneys in the federal case. Here, Dejanon explains why he believes this prosecution represents an escalation in the Trump regime's attack on people's right to protest and free speech.
Unfortunately, after the noise was finished and the noise demonstration was successful, when the people were leaving, an officer arrived from the local police department, from Alvarado Police Department, gets out of his car, draws his firearm towards some protesters who were running away, and that's when shots get fired in his direction. Then the officer shoots back three times, and then one of the bullets seems to have hit around his shoulder area. Because of that shooting, everything got so intense and aggressive against every single person that was even remotely connected to the noise demo. The government had actually charged a lot of people with first-degree attempted murder, and it was actually three counts because there was a Alvarado police and there were two ICE wardens, right? The people who work at the detention center that were there. It was three counts of attempted murder against multiple defendants because they said they had a plan and they were coordinating. But only Song was found guilty of one count for Alvarado police officer. What was awful is that the attorney was trying to argue self-defense and defense of others, right? The officer pulled his firearm first, but the judge didn't allow that argument. He banned it. He blocked it.
Is it legal for someone to shoot a police officer in self-defense?
I mean, the legal answer is that if the officer was acting unlawfully, right, like they had no reason to point their firearm at you and you were not provoking or anything, there is a right to self-defend against unlawful police conduct. I mean, this is the law across the country. It gets a bit murky when the officers say, no, there was grounds for suspicion of violence or there were grounds for an arrest. But generally, the right to self-defend is very strong in this country.
Javier Dejanon, how many people were convicted and on which charges?
The total number of defendants convicted federally were nine. Eight of them were charged on the riot, use of explosives to commit a felony, and the material support for terrorism. The ninth person, Des Sanchez, had separate charges for concealment of evidence. Des wasn't at the protest. It came out. He didn't even know it was happening. But his wife got arrested, and who did get convicted, and he helped move things from his wife's home.
What conclusions do you draw from this case, and why do you think it hasn't gotten the publicity that many other cases around the country have?
This federal government does not care about the truth. We all know this, right? We say it all the time. But again and again during the trial, even the cooperating defendants said, there is no Antifa cell. It doesn't exist. It's not real. But then after the convictions, Department of Justice issued a press release that said, we got the North Texas terror cell convicted. So this problem of truth, like, we all need to keep reminding ourselves and reminding especially centrist and maybe more middle of the road people, just because the Department of Justice is saying something doesn't mean it's true. This was a struggle for this case because the Department of Justice was saying terrorists, pre-planned ambush, attempted murder, and people really believed that that was true. When people on the ground are saying, no, we know it was a noise demo. Some of us saw the flyer, right? So I think that's a big thing. Like, what is true and part of authoritarianism is propaganda and telling people lies and convincing them. Separately, I think we all need to be aware of the fact that a noise demo resulted in felonies. I mean, federal felonies. The aggression of this government is that strong. And I think for me, it's a matter more of preparedness and understanding the legal potentials and being ready for them. For years now, we have seen how very simple protest cases have turned into felonies or into misdemeanors that take years to resolve. This explosion on anti-ICE sentiment really like escalated with Chicago and Portland and Minneapolis, especially. But all those things happened after July 4, 2025.
That was Xavier Desjardins, an attorney with the People's Law Collective. Learn more about the Prairie Land Domestic Terrorism Trial by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After more than a year of serving as the nation's Homeland Security Secretary, Kristi Noem was fired by President Trump on March 5th, following mounting condemnation of the brutal tactics employed in the regime's mass deportation campaign, including the ICE agent shooting deaths of two U.S. citizens, Renee Good and Alex Preddy, in Minneapolis. During congressional hearings in early March, lawmakers were also critical of the $220 million worth of advertising contracts that were signed to promote the agency's mission that prominently featured Noem dressed as a police officer, cowboy, soldier, and a construction worker. In late March, reports surfaced that the DHS Inspector General had launched a wide-ranging investigation into how contracts were solicited and handled, which directly involved possible ethical and criminal violations by both Noem and her de facto chief of staff, Corey Lewandowski. Soon after Noem's termination, Trump nominated and the U.S. Senate confirmed Oklahoma Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen to become the administration's new Homeland Security Secretary. Your reporter spoke with Kika Matos, president of the National Immigration Law Center, who reflects on Kristi Noem's destructive tenure and assesses what the nation can expect from Mark Wayne Mullen, who now leads DHS after a more than 40-day congressional deadlock over funding for the department, linked to Democrats' demand for major reforms to ICE.
Yeah, look, she came out of the gate swinging. By all appearances, including her own statements, she was carrying out Trump's mandate and Stephen Miller's mandate, but she made a few decisions that seemed to have really irked the president. And the last straw for him was the fact that she used your dollars and my dollars, our taxpayers' dollars, to the tune of $220 million to roll out these advertisements where she was featured. She was the central figure riding a horse in a number of places in front of Mount Rushmore, if I'm not mistaken. Speculation that she was really using this to center herself as a possible presidential candidate sometime in the future. That's part of the speculation. But she unleashed a level of brutality and lawlessness around immigration that we have never seen before. Minneapolis is the city that we are most familiar with, where we saw the shooting deaths of two Americans who were exercising their First Amendment rights to freedom of expression. But she, in essence, facilitated the creation of what many call a secret police or a paramilitary, that is ICE, and really normalized the idea that it is okay for law enforcement in this country to wear masks and to hide their identity and to engage in a level of violence and lawlessness directed at immigrants and U.S. citizens alike. It did not appear that Trump and his administration was as bothered by the violence and the authoritarian leanings of ICE that she authored. He was more bothered by the fact that she spent all of that money elevating her image.
Right, which conflicted with Trump's quest for attention all the time, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Kika, what's your impression of Oklahoma Senator Mark Wayne Mullen as the new Secretary of Homeland Security? He's got a history of endorsing violence in the Senate chambers, and he's made some statements that indicates he might depart somewhat from what Kristi Noem laid out in terms of her endorsement of the brutal mass deportation campaign endorsed by Donald Trump. What's your take on Mark Wayne Mullen as he takes over the DHS?
Look, this is, to me, the equivalent of putting lipstick on a pig. Mark Wayne Mullen is a hardline anti-immigrant person who, as a senator, embraced fully Trump's anti-immigrant policies. And just to offer up a few examples, he has been a vocal defender of the administration's mass deportation campaigns, you know, going so far as to describe ICE officers as patriots. He has expressed some skepticism about birthright citizenship and has openly stated that kids who are born in the U.S., in other words, U.S. citizen children whose parents are undocumented, if the parents are deported, he believes that the children should go with them to avoid family separation. He has also supported withholding federal funds for sanctuary cities that support their immigrant families. And following the shootings of Alex Preti and Renee Good, he first came out swinging, calling Alex Preti a deranged individual. He had to walk that back. But even today, he stands by his support of the officer who was involved in the shooting of Renee Good. So we're looking at somebody who is a hardliner when it comes to immigration issues, somebody who's not qualified for this position. He has a background in construction and ranching. He apparently had a talk radio show about home improvements. He has run a few businesses. He's an MMA fighter. But the kind of experience that you would think that a secretary of the Department of Homeland Security would have, he does not have. And it also appears that he has a bit of a hot temper. When a union leader was testifying, he challenged him to a physical fight.
Right.
And he also had a bit of a run-in with Senator Rand Paul, where he made some comment, a favorable comment, about Rand Paul being beaten by one of his neighbors, and Rand Paul took him to task on that. So the things that we should be concerned about are not just specific to the radical anti-immigrant positions that he has, but also it's really his lack of expertise and his ability to actually run such a large agency with such a big budget.
That was Kika Matos, president of the National Immigration Law Center and the Immigrant Justice Fund. Learn more about the immigrant rights community's concerns on Mark Wayne Mullen's leadership at DHS by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WGRN in Columbus, Ohio, KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, KMRE in Bellingham, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.